Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're kicking off our end-of-year fundraising drive with a special discount offer from our partner, Heritage Foods USA, an online farm-to-table butcher shop specializing in heritage-breed antibiotic-free meats. Donate to Heritage Radio Network before Sunday, December 4th at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and we'll send you an exclusive discount code for 10% off all Heritage Foods products. Help ensure another year of great food radio, get 10% off delicious and sustainably produced meat, and support small family farms all in one shot. How's that for a holiday miracle? Head to heritageradionetwork.org/donate by Sunday, December 4th to make your contribution.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Defining American cuisine has always been puzzling, and most descriptions come up as bland, simple flavors. But Sarah Lohman is here to shed light on some surprising flavors, old and new, on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And indeed, if you were to describe American cuisine, what would you say? Pot pie, mashed potatoes, roast, a big roast. Some people would say hamburgers and french fries, right? All without a lot of spice or high flavors. But Sarah Lohman, a historic gastronomist,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Historic gastronomist.
Culinary historian is fine, too.
Okay, that's a mouthful for me to get out otherwise. She has written a book. And did a sleuthing project on discovering some flavors that indeed are now American, are as common on the American pantry as any other, and also some old flavors that have been around for a long time that fell out of flavor. Mm-hmm. Her new book is called 8 Flavors: The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Sarah is, as I said, she's a culinary historian, a food historian. She likes to, you like to reproduce dinners and recipes and give events, but also a lot of research on some, you've been on this show a couple of different times.
Yeah, a couple times.
Yeah, interesting backgrounds into food that people wouldn't ordinarily think of and discover.
Yeah, most recently we sat down and talked about the history of funeral food.
Funeral food,
yeah.
Okay. Well, not to be a downer, but it would have been great for Halloween. It was kind of spooky, actually. But 8 flavors, I find it's really, you really did an interesting job, as I say, in the beginning, of old flavors and new flavors, but mm-hmm. not that new.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we've incorporated them into our daily regime of cooking. And we'll mention those as we go on.
Great.
And the book is coming out December 6th.
Next week on Tuesday. But you can pre-order it now from wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local independent bookseller.
Right. Some of these flavors that you talk about, as I said, they are really part of the everyday American kitchen. And
right.
then when you think about it, a lot of them were perhaps thought of as ethnic flavors at one time.
Right.
And I'm thinking particularly soy sauce or chili powder or sriracha. But then again, we are those flavors. We are a mosaic of people. Right?
Right. I think one of the big arguments I make in the book is for this broader definition of not only what American food is, but who an American is.
Right.
I'd say the two flavors that get called out the most on are curry powder and sriracha. Curry powder, which actually we've been using in America for over 200 years, and we've had immigrants from India coming to this country for over 100 years.
Well, the Brits actually brought it with them because they've been using it for much longer.
Absolutely. It really came to this country through our Anglo heritage, too, before it came with people from India. And the other is sriracha, and people don't really see these as American ingredients. Oh, well, that's Southeast Asian. So I am looking at these two ingredients and saying, well, you know, sriracha is sort of the end game of a long history of hot sauces in this country and a love of spicy hot pepper. And when you look at curry and see that not only Anglo-Americans have been using it for hundreds of years, but other people who have lived in this country for a very, very long time are using it. Why are we saying these flavors aren't American then? So what is behind that idea that we want to other these parts of these foods that have been a part of our culture for a very long time?
And then there are some flavors that kind of fell out of fashion that were very interesting and added a really, you know, an interesting depth to the cooking. And we can talk about those too. But what happened? Well, how did you get on this track of discovering some of these flavors, and why eight?
So I think it also comes from how what you were saying I like to do is a recreation, and I'll recreate meals or menus. I come from a living history background, which means in my late teens and early 20s, every summer I would put on a costume and I'd go live in the year 1848 at a museum in Ohio. And what happens in that sort of setting, whether it's where I worked or Colonial Williamsburg or Plymouth Plantation, is that I find that the employees, the people putting the costumes on, are often learning as much by doing as the visitors who are coming to this museum day to day. At least that was my experience. It put a personality on history. It made it human for me. Mm-hmm. And that's also where I was first introduced to historic food. We cooked in a wood-burning cast iron stove from historic recipes. So if we're going all the way back, that was the core of my interest, this idea of immersion, to learn, especially to learn about not only the past, but I think it's a great way to learn about other cultures too, contemporary cultures. This idea occurred very specifically to me when one day, years later, I was living in New York, doing my thing, doing my culinary history thing, and I just had this moment where I realized that I had not really seen vanilla in any baking recipes before the 1840s. Mm-hmm. And I literally like pulled the books down my shelf and started looking, and I'm like, no, it's not here. And I said, okay, but when does that happen? And I noticed by the end of the 19th century, vanilla was being used how we use it today and in the quantities really that we use it today. And so that is when I said, okay, something must have happened there. And I got really interested by how our food tastes different in different time periods, and what accounts for those changes, these pivotal moments, and I think more importantly, pivotal people that have changed American cuisine. So I kind of then created this timeline where I was looking at cookbooks in different eras and picking out the ingredients that seemed to pop up a lot. I ended up with about 30 different ingredients that then I was able to narrow down pretty easily, because it sort of would jump out to me how one ingredient like soy sauce can represent this larger cultural shift of increased immigration from China, or garlic, for example, can represent what it was like in America at the turn of the century and our attitudes. So I realized that these flavors were not only emblematic of larger chronological shifts in our history, but also I noticed that they were the most commonly used flavors. I used a handy tool called Google Ngram Viewer, which plots the occurrence of words on a graph. You can set parameters, American books from 1800 to the year 2000 is what I did. And I just looked.
How often did it pop up in recipes and things? Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, the whole book is interesting. And the flavors, not all of them being ethnic flavors. And I say some were in common use back in early America.
Absolutely.
And then fell out of favor and then, you know, picked up again. All, of course, coming from other places.
Sure.
And you mentioned our British, you know, the original, you know, Dutch or British
settlements. Necessarily coming from other places. I mean, again, with sriracha, people think it's exotic, yeah. but it's made entirely in Southern California. And of course, chili peppers are native to the United States too.
Hey, a guy named McElhaney made a fortune
exactly.
off of Tabasco. Right?
And Tabasco was founded in the 1860s yeah. too. So talking about your idea of American cuisine as thought of as bland, well, we've had hot sauce since really before the 1860s, but one of our major brands was founded in the 19th century.
Right, and so many of these flavors, you know, America has gone through, hopefully not again, but there were many periods of xenophobia.
Sure.
And a lot of the flavors that represented these ethnic cultures were eschewed by, you know, by those Americans who were already here. When I'm thinking about garlic, you mentioned in your book.
Yeah. It's an excellent example. And it also goes with this idea of something that was used and then fell out of favor. So garlic for a lot of American history was thought of as medicinal. And even in some early cookbooks, they say, this is not good for eating. But on the other hand, Mary Randolph's book, The Virginia Housewife, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, 1824, mm-hmm. 26, mm-hmm. somewhere in there, really one of the earliest major American cookbooks. She has a recipe where she uses like a whole like bulb of garlic in her recipe. So there is this question of like, all right, her book is very highly seasoned. By the end of the 19th century, though, we have discovered domestic science. We know what calories are. We know what nutrients are. So there becomes this real emphasis on creating balanced meals. And it's de-emphasized creating delicious meals. So the nutritional content is the most important. And spice, since it's not in their idea of food science, providing any sort of nutritional benefits is unnecessary. So we really see a decline in highly flavored foods in this country by the end of the 19th century. Then we have this massive Italian immigration between 1880 and 1920. And so garlic, a big part of Italian and Italian-American cuisine, becomes really emblematic of that. There was a lot of xenophobia against Italian immigrants to the point that in 1924, we essentially banned Italian immigration, putting in place a very, very strict quota that only let about 2,000 people in every single year, whereas about 10 times that amount had been coming in each of the previous years. And it was very explicitly racist, is what mm-hmm. this law was. So this garlic was seen as being the symbol of a group of people that were not thought of as being interested in becoming American. In fact, nearly half of all Italian immigrants didn't stay here and were eventually banned from this country because they were perceived as being an undesirable class of people to come here.
And their stinky food.
And their stinky food. Stinky Italians, right? This is idea. And now, in a way, we can laugh at that. We look back, at Italian culture, and in many ways, we're very unaware that that's how people felt in the time. Interestingly, in the modern era, there's a little bit of a shift in these two opposing ideas, that food represents cultures that we don't want to be a part here. It can, especially strongly flavored food, strongly smelling food. At the same time, in the country today, we often accept the food before we accept the immigrant themselves.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I buy hummus pretty much every time I go to the grocery store, right? And we have things like falafel and an increasing appearance of spices like za'atar and cardamom. So these are all major flavors that are coming from the Middle East. So we are simultaneously living in a world where there is, especially recently, pretty constant violence against Muslims in this country, at least in words, if not actions, but both. But at the same time, we are now very, very commonly eating foods that were brought here by these people and originated in the Middle East. And that, that's rough when you look yeah. at it, when you think that we're sort of missing this link between how our cuisine has changed because of the people who have come here and are simultaneously pushing away this group of Americans that have every right to be in this country.
That's right. You talked about some of the early dishes in your book. You're talking about vanilla
yeah.
and how that was, it had a lag time.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely story. Before we get to that story, let's name the eight flavors, because I think that's
sure.
okay. So I'm going to use my cheat sheet here.
Okay. I don't expect you to have them memorized. I'm
all
not
right.
quizzing you.
Okay. You do, I'm sure. So
I do. So chronologically,
right.
They as to when they appear in American kitchens and in increased popularity, we have black pepper, vanilla, chili powder, curry powder, soy sauce, garlic, monosodium glutamate, and sriracha.
Now, the monosodium glutamate is probably the one I don't find in my cabinet, I guess. But
You might be surprised.
It would be included in another ingredient.
Exactly.
But I would challenge most people to look in their kitchen cabinet and say, oh, I have all these flavors here. That's right. And they're pretty much considered standard usage ingredients.
Yeah, and if you don't think you have MSG, don't just check the prepackaged food, but you should. It's there. But also things like Marmite and Vegemite yeast extracts, that's pure monosodium glutamate. It's a naturally occurring ingredient.
Not a chemical.
Well, it is a chemical.
Not an artificial
exactly.
additive.
It's not artificial synthesized, chemical. I think is important. Right. Even when it's created in a lab, it's an extract from a fermentation process. So it's often put on labels as yeast extract. It's the same chemical, different name, different source too. So you might think that it's not in your cabinet, but it's absolutely there.
Yeah. And you talked about a lot of the early recipes did not contain vanilla because, and you're going to explain that. It's a cute, we're only going to tell a couple of the stories.
That's fine.
We want people to get the book and read the stories. But people were using other spices to add flavor.
Yeah, not just spices, but we can even say extract. So we use a lot of vanilla extract when we bake. Vanilla extract didn't come about until the second half of the 19th century. So before that, before the 1840s, every place that we use vanilla today, we used rose water, which really surprises people because today we do not think of rose water as an American ingredient. Again, we think of it coming from the Middle East or perhaps India and associated with those cuisines. But if you had said that to an American of the 18th century, they would have been like, what are you talking about? Like this, I have it in my cabinet. I use it all the time. It was a liquid extract, so it was easy to use with baking. And rose petals could be grown domestically, so it's something that could be made domestically in this country. So it was a very common, very popular flavoring. So how did we go from rose water to vanilla? Well, vanilla is actually native to Central America, and the Spanish had a monopoly on the vanilla trade. And people would take the plants and grow them in other places, particularly some of the French colonies off the coast of Africa. And the vines would grow in these tropical conditions, but they would blossom, but never fruit. Vanilla beans are the seed pod of an orchid. And these orchids, they weren't pollinating, people realized after a while. They thought, okay, there must be some native pollinator in Mexico that we don't have. So what do we do? So it took a very special person to figure this out. There was a plantation owner in Ile de Bourbon, which is, again, a French colony off the coast of Africa. And he had a slave named Edmond. And both the owner, Ferrier Bayet Beaumont, and Edmond were very interested in botany. Ferrier gave him an education on the plantation. And one day they were walking the plantation together, so the plantation master writes, and he noticed that his vanilla orchid had beans on it. And he asked Edmond how this happened. And Edmond said, I figured it out. And he had. This boy, he was 12 years old at the time, 12 years old, figured out the hand pollination technique that we still use to this day. Vanilla is still hand pollinated. It has to be.
Melon, a lot of things are, especially when you want to keep organic or, you know, or one variety type.
Which is also the, turns into some of the most expensive spices in the world, often have to be hand processed. Right. So he created this. It's changed the world in terms of the vanilla industry. It changed American food in terms of how it tastes, because now vanilla was more affordable because it could be grown in more places, and even extract. They were now, beans weren't as precious, so you could kind of chop them up, turn into an extract, which is a more cost-effective product than a single vanilla bean. He gained his freedom in 1848, but there were no opportunities for free black men in either Réunion or here in the United States should a black man gain his freedom, not even to mention a black woman. And he died in poverty. So that, to me, that is really what the vanilla chapter focuses on, not just about how extraordinary this turning point was in terms of science, botany, technology, but I also really look at the lives of young black men in this country.
How these things happened.
Exactly.
Who was behind it?
Exactly.
How did it happen? Before, and vanilla, I mean, being such an aromatic it was used also, you know, perfumes and, mm-hmm. and all, but yeah. it just had very expensive ingredients.
Very expensive. Was, yes. So in a way, naturally produced vanilla only counts for less than 5% of the vanilla that we consume. Fragrances, flavors rely very heavily on vanillin, which is a very simple chemical compound that can be reproduced in a lab. Traditionally, it comes from lignin, which is a chemical in wood. If you've ever, I always say, you know, if you taste bourbon and you taste vanilla notes, that's actually oxidized lignin that is in that bourbon. So this chemical is placed in, it's in many, many, many other places, and now we sort of pull it from other places and create synthesized vanillin. Vanillin is the main aromatic and flavor component in a vanilla bean. It accounts for about 2/3 of our sensory experience of vanilla. And the other 1/3 is over 200 other chemicals and compounds that lend itself to aromatics and to flavor.
Well, we're glad that he did, that he figured out the hand pollination. Prior to that, a lot of unusual things, or not unusual, they were very common in early America, but unusual to us today in our sweet recipes, a lot of more savory herbs and spices would be used to flavor cookies and cakes. And you discovered a recipe for black pepper in particular. Right?
Yes, yeah. Black pepper is the one that I really noticed that has now become a savory spice, but historically it was used along all the other spices coming from that part of the world, all the other fiery spices like cinnamon and ginger to a certain extent, cloves. They were all being sort of blended together. And black pepper was used historically in savory recipes as well. But the book I discovered this in is a collection of recipes that were owned by Martha Washington. They actually came from her first husband's family as a wedding gift given to her in 1747. And this is a valuable manuscript because, as you know, we don't have our first printed American cookbook until 1796.
Right.
So to get information about what Americans were eating before...
Amelia Simmons, we'd have to tell our listeners.
Oh, yes. Amelia Simmons, American Cookery, 1796. It's available in its entirety online. You can look it up. And that's really considered, it's not only the first cookbook written and published in America, but also really seems to focus on American ingredients, too.
Right.
Before that, we have to look at manuscripts. So that is why her collection of recipes is very helpful. And some of the recipes are would not only be 18th century, but it's thought that it stretches as far back to the late medieval period, like maybe looking at the 14th or 13th centuries, too. So one of the recipes I pulled for there was for cakes that can be kept in ye house for 6 months to a year.
Ye house.
I think I'm, ye house. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but ye house is definitely a part of it. And they were, they had as much ground spice as flour, so they were extremely decadent cookies for the time. To our modern palate, they were pretty disgusting, to be honest. And I did make them and put them in ye house for a year, and they were remarkably unperturbed when I opened them a year later.
Kind of like that old fruitcake sitting in the back of the
cabinet. That's exactly what it was like. And it was, and there is some comparison. They also had like dried and candied fruits, but you didn't like... The flavor also didn't change. It didn't mature like a fruitcake does. Anyway, if you're curious, up on my blog, I modernized the recipe because I loved the idea of putting black pepper into a spice cookie. So sometimes when I make a historic recipe and I'm like, oof, this is bad, but I like this core idea, I create this modern version. I think it's very inspiring.
Yeah, interesting. And it's not uncommon to see black pepper in old recipes for spice cake, gingerbread, things
exactly.
like that. It'll come up in that.
That's really what these were, sort of like a gingerbread cookie, a very, very dense cookie. And it's a trend that's coming back, too. There's been a couple recipes floating around, one in the New York Times for a devil's food cake with a black pepper icing, too. So again, if you're interested in recipes, my blog, by the way, is 4 pounds flour. You can jump on there. And I'm posting all this week, really all this month, a lot of information that kind of didn't make it into the book, you know, my behind the scenes a little bit. So today I actually have some graphs up about where you can actually see where these flavors came into American cooking over time and kind of how they waned in popularity and grew in popularity. It's all those data visualizations are up there today.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about more of these stories when we come back after this short break. Thank you.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sauchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sauchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sauchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Sarah Lohman. And Sarah has written a book called, she's a historic gastronomist, culinary historian, and she's written a book called Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. And in this, Sarah, you, before we get on to the other, some of the other flavors, I wanted to mention you were saying that obviously, Amelia Simmons, many of us know, in 1796, that was the first printed cookbook.
Published in America.
There were other
cookbooks published here, to be fair, just so there's not, like, culinary historian internet trolls. But they were British books that some had updated chapters for American cooking and then were republished here in the States. She's the first author who wrote a book in America. It was published in America, and it was really about American cooking, 1796.
And we still do rely on manuscripts. And I just wanted to mention there is a website that has put many of these manuscripts up online so you can research them online. And it's called, or go to the library. A lot of libraries have gotten them online as well, but not quite to the extent. The website I'm talking about is called Manuscript Cookbooks Survey. That's cookbooks, plural, survey. ManuscriptCookbooksSurvey.com.
That's cool.
And, yeah, it's a wonderful site where you can access some of these old manuscripts and
I haven't heard of it. I can't wait to go and dig around.
Exactly what you found.
I already have more projects than I know what to do with, but that's what I do. I just keep adding more to the list. So,
You know, we were talking about immigration and xenophobia, and there is an interesting story that was written up that you told, and it's in the book about how we didn't accept the immigrant himself, but of course his cooking became very popular and we like a lot. And that was kind of a bittersweet story, very much so, as many of these are.
You're talking about the story of Prince Ranjit Smile.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. That's a story I was really excited to tell, and one that I was very surprised that there's been very, very, very little writing about this man up until this point. Mine is the first, but a colleague of mine has a book coming out about him sometime, and I'm really excited about it too, because he is, I could only do one chapter and he's doing the whole book. Okay, so why am I so excited about this guy? So Smile was born in what is today Pakistan, but at the time was India, and he ends up cooking in a very fine hotel in London. And Lewis Sherry in 1899 goes to this hotel. Now, Sherry has probably the best restaurant in New York City at that time. It was maybe second only to Delmonico's. It was a very well-known,
and there weren't too many at that time.
Exactly. And it was very much focused on a high-end clientele. He's staying in London. He stays at this hotel, and he's basically like, who's cooking this food? This is awesome. This is amazing. He didn't use the word awesome. Paraphrase. We don't know what happened. Today's lingo. He poaches this chef, he's a pretty young man at this point. I think he's only about 20 years old, and says, you're coming to cook in New York City. And so this guy, Ranjit Smile, comes and cooks in New York, and he is a sensation, like, from the beginning. Sherry gives him a place to cook in the kitchen. He tells the French chefs that dominate to leave him alone, that this is Smile's spot. This is where he's going to cook. And Sherry's offers this curry menu to New Yorkers in 1899. And there are some wonderful, what I would call like restaurant reviews, like food blogs about reporters going and having these experiences, not only talking about how much they like this really new food to them, because Smile really wanted to introduce what he thought was more authentic Indian cooking to America, but also like they genuinely talk about how like sexy this guy is, which I think is really amusing too. Like everybody talks about how hot he is. He's got like all these girlfriends. He's married like three times. Like he's really also kind of sensational in that regard. regard to. Like, he was in the gossip columns as much as he was heralded for his cooking abilities. He goes on to have this very successful career, being famous not just in the city, but he tours the country doing cooking demos, cooking for prestigious dinners, and is very, very, very famous. Always says he wants to write a cookbook. I haven't discovered that manuscript, but I think I would fall over and die from happiness the day I did, and is very famous. The bittersweet part of this story is I discovered a New York City Hall of Records, his application for citizenship, and it was amongst a group of documents in which the applications were denied. In this point in American history, it was very, if you were brown, it was difficult to get your citizenship because our Constitution said you can be a naturalized citizen if you're white, and then it later on said you can be a naturalized citizen if you're black. But if you were somewhere in between, it was a really sort of difficult territory. So it depended really judge by judge. One judge might say, yes, you look white, you can be a citizen. Another might say, yes, you look black, you can be a citizen. Great. Another judge might say, no, you don't fall into either of those categories, you can't be a citizen. And there was a massive court case that went to the Supreme Court in early 19th century where all of these rulings were overturned because the Supreme Court decided that someone who is Asian, whether that's some Southeast Asian like Smile was or someone from China, Japan, Korea, could not be American according to the Constitution as written. So even men who had gotten their citizenship then had it revoked. So there's this moment where he's been in the country at this point for now 30 years, and he wants to be a citizen. He's got an American wife, and he's rejected. Shortly after that, prohibition hits, which really affected the restaurant industry, and pretty soon after, he leaves the country. And after that point, he just kind of falls off the face of the earth in a way. I don't know what happened to him, but it's pretty heartbreaking that he spent more than half of his life in this country, and this country rejected him, said that he could not become American.
But we wanted to eat his food.
We wanted to read about his love life. We wanted to see him in person. We embraced him in all these other ways, but he was denied the chance to embrace the country himself.
Interesting. That's what is really quite interesting about the book, that it's not just a tale of flavors and foods and how they're used, but really the people behind it. And you put a face on it. And in your early experience, you said,
you put a face on history, because at the same time, it's, you know, what is food except to feed humans? It's made by people. It's for other people. So the stories are never about the food itself. It's about the people on the other end of that, the people behind those flavors. That's where the powerful stories are.
What flavors do you feel have fallen, flavors and favors?
Yeah.
What flavors that might have been used in early American cooking have sort of fallen out of favor? You mentioned rosewater as being one.
Rosewater is a big one, to the point where we don't even remember it's American anymore.
Right.
And it's also fascinating to see, as more and more flavors come from the Middle East, in my conclusion, that's one of the flavors I prophesize might become an American flavor again. We're seeing it more. We're seeing it paired with cardamom. There was an article in the New York Times a few years ago where they suggested replacing vanilla with rosewater, which I thought was really great because it's this total throwback to 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So you might be seeing a lot more rosewater used outside of its sort of Indian or Middle Eastern context and going back to its American roots, too. Another one that's kind of a mystery is mace.
Yeah.
I don't talk about this in the book, but if you've worked in culinary history like you have, Linda, you see it all the time in early American recipes. So what is it? Nutmeg is a fruit. I've never had the nutmeg fruit itself, and maybe someday. The nutmeg that we use is the seed of this nutmeg. And between the fruit and the seed, there is this red membrane.
It looks like a dried netting. Right?
Yeah, like on a dried netting. Or kind of when it's on the nutmeg, it kind of looks like a brain to me a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
You know, look it up on the internet. See a picture of it. And it's this interesting spice that tastes a little bit like nutmeg, but it's also a little bit hotter, I would
peppery.
Say, too. Mm-hmm. A little peppery, exactly. Beautiful color as well. And it was used just as commonly as nutmeg was in historic America. And we just don't use it anymore. You'll see it again. It's easy to find in Indian spice stores, and it's used quite a bit in the Caribbean too, but not in mainstream American cooking, which really, and I don't have an explanation. Some culinary historians call it the mace mystery. sometimes it might be, I did read a story about black pepper and long pepper. Long pepper is another Indian spice that used to be used pretty commonly, not in America, but in Europe. And it sort of dwindled after chili peppers were introduced to Europe. And the historian that puts forth that story said, well, we just didn't need to have three spices that kind of tasted the same.
Right.
You know, so we got rid of one. So that might be the story of nutmeg and mace.
And mace is so labor intensive.
Yeah. You can't grate it like nutmeg. You have to pound it and grind it. So maybe we just didn't need two spices that kind of tasted the same. We just picked the one that was easier to deal with.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know what? Marjoram is one that...
Marjoram and savory. Those are great examples, too.
They're always in my kitchen garden, my herb garden outside. But you don't see that appear a lot in recipes.
No, you don't. They historically were called the sweet herbs, and they were used almost always to flavor poultry. Marjoram, savory, and sage. And out of the three of those, we only use sage. But especially in the 18th century and early 19th century, it was these three herbs always together. That was your stuffing for your turkey. That's what you put on your boiled chicken. And we don't use marjoram and savory that much. And interestingly, if I sat here and thought about it, I really couldn't describe the flavors to you. Herbal. Right?
There is almost a floral kind of essence to it. You had mentioned in your book a beef stew that was lacking flavor when you tried a revolutionary restaurant.
Yeah,
and they gave you a beef stew that didn't have that in it.
Yeah, that was in a way the kind of inspiration point for the rest of my life. Years later in college, I went to art school and I went to a 5-year program, Cleveland Institute of Art. And I had to come up with a thesis. And I knew I wanted to do something with the interpretation of history because I'm fascinated by how we reinterpret the past. And I ended up going to this historic restaurant here on the East Coast that was basically the same time period that I had worked in. So I'd grown very, very accustomed to how things from that time tasted. And I was amped. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have this food that I remember. And they had things on the menu that did exist in the 1830s, like beef stew or apple pie, but when they served them, they were flavored the way that they are flavored in the 21st century, not in the 19th century. So like that apple pie was missing rose water, and it was missing maybe nutmeg, and did it with the beef stew. Like nutmeg and mace appeared a lot in meat recipes too. Those flavors are so typical of that time period. And then things like marjoram and savory, this sort of herbal palate that I remember wasn't there. And I just remember thinking, well, gosh, like why can't someone just do this right? And I was like, uh-oh. And I spent basically the next 9 months of my life, you know, working my butt off. And I produced this, it was what you now call a pop-up restaurant in 2005 in Cleveland that served colonial era food for a contemporary audience. And then that has been the jumping off point for my whole career. Really wanting to bridge this gap between culinary history and foodie culture, understanding where our food comes from and why, knowing that we can pull from the past in the same way that we sort of pull from other cultures for inspiration, making this connection and this gap that used to exist between these two groups of people.
Well, it's very interesting that the way that you fall into different, in different careers. And I'm very glad that you leaned to the history, but you do it with a very artful mind.
I do. And I, when I first moved to New York, I was working for Grub Street as a videographer. So I got the time to be in some of the best kitchens in New York City and talk to the best chefs. And it produced to me such a respect for the work they do and also a realization that was not for me. The hours, the labor in the kitchen, you really have to love it. So although I may have thought about going to culinary school or opening my own restaurant, after those couple years seeing that work, I was like, you know what? You guys are doing a bang-up job. This is not for me. I will not be happy here. That's how I ended up where I am.
Good realization.
It was.
Out of these flavors that you, the list that you culled, because you said you had 30, I don't know.
Yeah.
8 flavors has a better ring to it than 30 flavors. 30 flavors you'd have to plod through.
It really just kind of, and you know what? Yes, I didn't want to do a book that was sort of a listicle book, you know, all these little stories.
Yeah.
I wanted to create one long story. And to be honest, there really wasn't a lot of fight. Like things just sort of fell into their place. And when I picked out the 8 made sense. They fell chronologically. Yeah. It just happened.
Although we do have a little repeat here with chili and sriracha. We got a lot of hot spices and some of the black peppers. But was there one flavor that you covered that kind of won your heart?
I mean, I think it probably is sriracha. Which is one that's not everybody who reads the book might have heard of yet, but now this will make you very aware of it. And it's another story that really hasn't been put to paper. There's been some articles about it, but nothing like this. And so I'm glad to be the historian to sort of enter this into our Culinary History Chronicles. Sriracha, as I mentioned, is produced entirely in Southern California, and it's made by the Tran family. David Tran is from Vietnam, and he was making hot sauce to support his family before and during the Vietnam War. After the fall of Saigon, his family is ethnically Chinese, and they were one of the groups targeted with the rise of communism and were being forcibly removed from the country. So he escaped with his family on a dilapidated freighter and sailed for Hong Kong. When they showed up, Hong Kong said, "Turn around, we don't want you here." And the ship dropped anchor in international waters and just waited. And luckily, Hong Kong was deemed an international port of refuge, and so they were admitted after about a month of being on the ocean. And his family, by 1980, was placed here in America, actually in Boston in January, which is, to me, is really palpable. Cruel. From Vietnam, from Hong Kong to Boston in January. Yeah. His brother, though, got placed outside of Los Angeles, and David Tran told me all he was thinking was, "I have to do something to support my family." He called up his brother, and he said, "Do they have hot peppers out there?" His brother said, "Yes." This was January 1980. By February 1980, he was making sriracha hot chili sauce. And he says that since that first day, he's not been able to make enough to keep up with demand.
Well, there was a little issue there for a while. In fact, you went out and you covered the story where the community was complaining about the smells emanating from the
Interestingly, I didn't go out to cover that story, but it happened to happen at the same time.
Well, I guess we talked about it here then.
Yeah.
Well, for me, you covered it.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, and afterwards I wrote about it because they had just moved to a new factory in Irwindale, a massive, massive, massive factory. It looks like that last scene in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you know, where there's this big warehouse. That's what it is. And there was a lot of weird politics going on at that time, but the complaints were that their chili grinding season lasts from about August to November. And the community was complaining that the fumes from the factory were, people were tearing up, they were coughing, things like that. I can't speak for the day-to-day experience, but about a week before that story broke, that's when I was there, you know, in the height of this chili grinding season. And Irwindale is very, very industrial. And so when I got out of my car, it didn't smell like chili peppers. It smelled like burning tires, to be honest with you. And the only place I smelled that hot chili smell was in the grinding room, which is an inside room that has like a kind of a special set of doors to get into to contain that really abrasive smell. So I just kind of put it out there. I'm like, hey, I was just there. And I think there are probably some other things going on there. Beyond that, though, this factory, they're going to outgrow their new factory, which was new in 2013, within another 2 to 3 years. So they I'm sure, already thinking about how to branch out if they need to start a new factory. One of the things that's been stopping them is that all of the peppers for sriracha are grown by one family farm in Southern California.
Wow.
They've had a partnership, Craig Underwood and David Tran. Craig's the farmer, David's the founder of Sriracha. They've had a partnership for 30 years together. So they have been working together. So they have to figure out how expanding with the demand is really a challenge for the farmers, too, to be able to grow that many peppers for how much Americans want to consume this hot sauce.
Yeah. Well, you said maybe some of our listeners don't know what it is yet, and yet, then again, some people who didn't know about it 10 years ago, it's on the table.
It's on the table.
It's one of their regular spices. So that's the growth is really
remarkable. It's on
remarkable.
The shelves in Walmart. So I feel like by anyone's standards, that is American. You can get a really good deal for it at Walmart, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is just one of the many stories that you tell. And it really is an interesting take on the mosaic America that we really are.
Yeah.
And not the America that we think we read about in the history books.
Yeah, to me, all of these flavors and all of these people are Americans. And I think that especially now, that's a really important thing to remember, that our country is not about homogeny, it's about diversity. And that's what has made us so great for so long.
Yeah, and great, rich culture of food, too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah Loma. It's
my pleasure.
Always a pleasure. And the name of the book, again, is 8 Flavors, The Untold Stories of American Cuisine.
It's out with Simon & Schuster. You can get it wherever books are sold.
Oh, nice commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And I would like to thank my ever so generous engineer, David Tadashore. David has put all these shows together so well over the years. And please, if you like the show, go visit the website, heritageradionetwork.org, where we have thousands of more shows on many different topics, all usually about food. And we are a member-supported network. So please, you'll see the little red heart beating in the upper right-hand corner. Click on that red heart and give what you can. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.